Access to energy is the golden thread that weaves together economic growth, human development, and environmental sustainability. The number of people worldwide without access to electricity decreased from 1.7 billion in 2000 to 1.1 billion in 2016. However, nearly all of those 600 million people who gained access to electricity between 2000 and 2016 did so through power generation from fossil fuels. Fossil fuels play a major role in global warming. In today's world, energy is the dominant contributor to greenhouse gases. IPCC, the Intergovernmental Panel for Climate Change, says that activities related to energy are responsible for 60% of total greenhouse gases in the atmosphere. In October last year, United Nations warned that we have 12 years left to limit global warming to a maximum of 1.5 degrees relative to pre-industrial era. To make sure we keep global warming in check, global carbon emissions need immediate reduction, faster than ever, and need to hit zero by 2050. Else, humanity is in trouble. Ladies and gentlemen, as the Director of Energy, Oxford Business Network at Syed Business School, I'm pleased to introduce you to this panel that brings together speakers from entrepreneurial, policy, and investment perspectives to discuss the following: how innovative finance can bring access to sustainable energy and corresponding business models around it, how budding entrepreneurs and entrepreneurs can help make this world more sustainable, and the third is what policy changes are needed to not breach the limit of 1.5 degrees. So in the panels we have today, Nikhil Nair, Director of Sales at Ancopa Solar, a reputable company that brings solar energy to more than 500,000 homes in East Africa. Shalini Rao, Director of Global Generation Impact Investment, a company that holds investments in companies at the forefront of sustainability, such as Ancopa Solar. Nikki Chambers, a serial ecopreneur with 30 years of experience in sustainable business and currently CEO of Origin Power, a company that is working on negative emissions technology. Thank you. To kick off the discussion, I would request panelists to briefly say a few words about their background and the topics they would like to engage in with the audience. Thank you.
Thanks. Morning, great to be back at SBS. I was a student here many years ago, so nice to be on this side of the table. So I work at Ancopa Solar, which is an asset financing business based out of Kenya. So we make solar home systems affordable to rural households by using mobile technology, that is GSM, and mobile payments. So perhaps I'll get into the details of that a little later. My background has been in solar. I've been about 10 years in this business of working in East Africa, before that in India, and I was also working for a manufacturing plant producing solar cells and solar panels.
Good morning. My name is Shalini Rao. I work with Generation Investment Management, which is an investment management firm set up by a group of founding partners about 15 years ago, two of whom probably best represent what we're trying to do, our CEO, the former head of Goldman Sachs Asset Management Wing, a gentleman by the name of David Blood, and then our chairman, former Vice President Al Gore. And so when you sort of marry the backgrounds of David and his financial acumen and investor experience with Al's deep devotion and commitment of his career to sustainability, I think you get to the heart of what we're trying to do, which is to prove that when you integrate sustainability into the investment process, you're actually able to drive outperformance and longer-term returns. So with around $20 billion in assets under management, we're trying to prove that we can do better than all other investors, effectively, and really showcase that you don't need to sacrifice value for values, but that if you take a long-term time horizon, they're fundamentally one and the same. I sit with our growth equity strategy, so investing in private companies that we believe will be on the right side of history.
I'm Nikki Chambers. I'll just go on a fairly flippant bio of mine. I have a degree in environmental science, a master's in environmental technology, to which my mother said, "What on earth are you going to do with that?" And I looked at a park warden. I said, "What's wrong with being a park warden?" And then I worked for the Confederation of British Industry, and my job was described by the then Director General as wandering around the country stirring up apathy. And then I got vexed that there were no ways of judging sustainability either from an investment way or indeed what directional thing, where was a CEO going in the right direction. And so I came across the concept of ecological footprinting, how many planets we would need, and there from carbon footprinting, and spent about 20 years developing the data and the mechanisms and software around the whole sort of carbon footprinting agenda. So I like to think of myself slightly as queen of carbon footprinting. My notes now. Then I spent a lot of time working with corporates. So actually, I didn't work in any Tesco's or Coca-Cola's, but was consultant to many of them, trying to improve their performance, if you like, on strategy metrics and whatever. And then about five, and built a company around that to about 45 people, working with big companies. And then I had a bit of a crisis of this isn't enough. So 3% more efficient every year is not going to get us where we need to go. So I sold up, and I've been looking for a company who could really, or a technology which could really switch the dial on the scale of the challenge ahead of us. Discovered Origin Power, discovered at the same time that even if on the 1.5 degree report, every single scenario in the 1.5 degree report requires us to take in the region of 730 billion tonnes of carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere, as well as doing all the heroic things to not put any more in. And we have nothing, we have no technologies to do that. So that's what Origin Power is doing, and that's what I'm currently raising money to do.
I'm going to start with Nikki, because you mentioned that you work with companies like Tesco and Coca-Cola, and to build upon your experience, how can we increase the collaboration between different stakeholders and incentivize system-level intervention to be more sustainable? It's clearly that the big corporations need to do a lot more than, because they are mainly responsible for the carbon emissions.
I think it does really reflect my journey of the big companies have the resources and the incumbency to make the changes, but the system doesn't always make it easy for them because the investors aren't particularly aren't always like Generation, and they want to see profit before and not necessarily long term profit. So it's a bit of a double edged sword about whether you bet on the big companies delivering something. Or whether you bet on smaller disruptors coming up and kind of and eating some of the big companies' pie in a more sustainable way, or in a radically sustainable way. And that's always the sort of the judgment, really, which horse to bet. But actually, increasingly, I think I'm realising you absolutely need both. And so a lot of my strategy with working with Origin Power, for example, is finding the big companies who need a radical solution to what they're doing, or to do what they're doing in a radically different way, and actually take them on the journey with you with that mix of entrepreneurship and big company might and potential investment. It's not a done deal, it's not totally easy, but I think if we're looking at a transition, then everyone has to be involved. We just have to involve everyone, and that includes policy, which is possible policy and money, which is probably the two hardest ones. It's not largely a technical problem. It's a political and economic problem.
Just a follow-up question on that. How do you think the end consumer's expectations be changed so that we put more pressure on the big companies?
So, again, that's something I'm a bit conflicted about, because I've spent a lot of... And actually, made some good contract money out of teaching companies to how to appeal to the sustainably alert consumer or whatever. But actually, I think that is possibly not the way to do it. And actually, we need corporate leadership, because it's a systemic problem, and you can't actually always expect individuals within the system to change the system by buying more or buying differently. So we need corporate and policy leadership as well as a willing electorate, if you like, to make that a valid way forward.
Thank you. Next question I have is for Nikhil, because we did have a discussion on the district disruptors and how can disruptors change. I would like to know how did the founders of MCOPA came about creating a solar business in East Africa, the sustainability.
Sure, thanks. So a bit of background, the founders of MCOPA are people who created M-Pesa, which is a prominent mobile payment platform in the world. M-Pesa is a product of Vodafone that works in Safaricom in Kenya. And mobile payments in Kenya is far ahead of what you see in the Western world. So you do not need a card, you do not need wallets, you only need your mobile phone, you do not need internet to transact money on M-Pesa. This was started in 2005. And just to give you some statistics, about 40% of Kenya's GDP goes through M-Pesa, so which is unheard of in any other country to have that many number of transactions going through M-Pesa. So M-Pesa was started in 2005 by a colleague of ours, Nick Hughes, while he was at Vodafone. And about 5 years into running the business, he realized that you now have access to people paying from remote distances, but they also need products and services. So one thing is to allow you to pay, but what else can people in rural Kenya get access to? So how do you take products and services to them? And working in telecom space, he was very inspired by the prepaid technology. So like the way we use our phone, where we buy 10 quid and then it runs out of credit. So he thought that the meter was a very underutilized asset of being able to turn off and turn on something remotely. So when you look at people in rural Kenya and you look at their income, you realize that a disproportionate amount of money is spent on energy, because it's hard to get them to increase their disposable income. So you have to displace something to sell them something else. So about 20 to 25% of their income was spent on energy, and it's typically buying coal, kerosene, or any kind of crappy fuels. So the idea was, why don't you put a SIM card inside a battery and turn it off remotely if the customer is not able to pay? And the way you make them pay is through M-Pesa. So we have about 700,000 customers now in East Africa, about 7 years later, where a customer pulls out his phone every night, gets onto M-Pesa, doesn't need the internet, sends money to MCOPA, and we turn on the device remotely. All of this happens in a couple of seconds. So when you're talking of Internet of Things, this is very much one of those ideas, but it's working in communities that probably do not have access to basic infrastructure, education. They've probably never seen electricity in their households. So that was the idea around how you can take innovative technology and disrupt a marketplace, or give them access to energy that they wouldn't have access to otherwise. So that was the motivation coming from telecom, M-Pesa, and looking at how both these technologies could get combined to create a business like MCOPA. So we are a solar business, but we are also very much an asset financing business, because we're actually putting out a $230 loan, which the customer pays over a 1 or 2 year period. So when people ask us, saying, are you a tech business, are you a solar business, or are you a financing business, we are a combination of all the three in many ways.
Wow, that sounds amazing. I think the follow-up question would be like clearly you have been at the forefront of financial innovation to bring energy to the energy access to the masses. How do you see the financial ecosystem for this kind of innovation has evolved, and how the behavior of investors has evolved over the previous decade?
Good question. So I think access to finance is such a critical piece in a lot of the communities that we work with, because often if you think of us buying, let's say, a car, if I want to buy a car, maybe $15,000, I do not have access to $15,000 cash today, but my bank allows me to make a car affordable or a mortgage affordable. But most of the people living in rural sub-Saharan Africa or in India do not have access to financial services. So they're not able to make that leap of buying a $230 system. So to your question around how has technology or how has things evolved, I should tell you a story of my previous company that I worked in Bangalore. In 97 or 98 is when the founder started a very rudimentary pay-as-you-go model, which now is a big business in East Africa using technology, and companies like MCOPA do that. But what the entrepreneur did then was he found one guy who would go and charge 20 batteries every night. Through the day he would charge 20 batteries. Every evening he would find people who were street hawkers and go and rent it out to them for 10 rupees. So people would either buy kerosene or they would choose to rent out a light. So that was a very early form of pay-as-you-go, where I would show up every day at your doorstep and say, hey, do you want to buy a light? It's 10 rupees. If you say no, I go back and I sell it to somebody else. Now, at that time, we did not have access to technology, or there was no more thinking around how you can scale this processor. Now, fast forward about 15 years later, Jesse was the founder of MCOPA. He visited Selco and was very inspired by this idea of people being able to pay daily and having the option to switch on their lights when they wanted it. And when Nick Hughes came up with the idea of putting a SIM card, he said, I absolutely know how this is going to work. I've seen it in India 10 years ago. You can put a SIM card in and you can actually finance, the customer can pay for this on a daily basis. So that evolution has happened, and that's not because of what companies like MCorp are doing, it's because GSM costs have gone down. You know, GSM modules used to be $20 a unit, it's less than $5. Solar panels used to cost $7 a watt, now they're less than a dollar per watt. So the macro trends have definitely helped drive these technologies and make it more accessible to people.
Thank you. It's very inspiring. Next question I'm going to ask to Shalini, because Shalini, the generation has invested in MCorp and many other sustainable businesses. So, Shalini, what are the things do you look for in a startup, and how do you find a balance between financial growth, because you are ultimately a private equity company, and so balance between financial growth and environmental sustainability in your investment portfolio?
Yeah, I mean, it's a fantastic question and part of the fundamental mission of the firm. But I'd sort of, you know, challenge anyone asking that question to hear what Nikhil has just said and think of sort of returns and beneficial outcomes as in any way mutually exclusive. In our view, they're just, you know, one and the same. And so I think if you think with a longer term time horizon and you price externalities appropriately, you arrive on a ton of commercial opportunity that is really quite viable. And so the whole ethos and goal of our firm is to prove that we can be just as competitive as your conventional private equity firms, as your conventional public equities firms, but really, you know, allocate capital towards some of these longer term trends and invest behind that commercial opportunity. And I think to Nikki's point, however, you know, there is no one stakeholder in this entire discourse that is an exogenous determinant of some of these sustainability outcomes. Instead, what you need is every stakeholder to really work together. So you need that consumer push. You need sort of innovation and business models that are thinking not just about sort of, you know, what is the value proposition to the end consumer? How do you take kerosene out of a house and benefit, you know, human health within that household, but also fundamentally, you know, create some sort of ROI for the person who actually has to make that fairly short-term decision. But then also, how do you think about sort of revolutionizing the energy space for sort of off-grid solar? So we think that there is a lot to be said around business innovation. We're seeing a lot of push in terms of consumer behavior really driving a lot of that innovation. But then we fundamentally believe that investors play a key role in how we allocate capital is really important. So I think if anything, you know, I'm so pleasantly surprised and happy to see how many of you have come to the energy panel, because, you know, we've all been talking about energy for some time, and I often feel a bit disenchanted by how little policy is really moving the dial and how policy has shifted, particularly after Paris and sort of the US pulling out of the Paris Agreement. But I think that there's so much to be said about the power of all other actors coming together. And so to answer your question, Saurabh, I think it's, you know, you need to remove a lot of the distortionary nudge effects that you have for investors. So in the public markets, you need to remove things like quarterly earnings guidance and replace it instead with, you know, a far more integrated type of reporting that incorporates a lot of these other externalities that aren't currently being priced in. And then I think, you know, LPs and clients of investors really need to push through things like, you know, divestment, or, you know, just through sort of how they allocate their capital and to which investors they're really sort of, you know, how each of you have your pensions allocated. Have you all thought about like where your pension money is going and where you actually want to derive any sort of future income from, you know, in 30 years' time? Do you think that the likes of ExxonMobil or any of these other sort of big companies that aren't necessarily pricing in externalities today are still going to be viable financial options moving forward? I'm not entirely sure. But there's a lot of pressure on each of us for different sort of incentives to, you know, price towards things that are going to be viable in the long term. So I think, if anything, investors have this responsibility, and it's quite difficult. You know, it's like sustainability investing still isn't mainstream yet. You're seeing the emergence of a lot of sort of sustainability funds and indexes, which we think is great. And the only thing you need to make sure is that that type of innovation isn't pro-cyclical. So it's not just because markets are quite frothy right now that you have a lot of private equity funds focused on sustainability, but that you're going to continue to see that increase regardless of market outcomes, because that's the way the world ought to be. So to answer your question, yeah, they're not mutually exclusive.
Thank you. Because you did mention about the pension fund investing in shale gas or investing in ExxonMobil and things. The follow-up question for me that I will ask is, like, how can we make shareholders more responsible? How can we actually be proactive? Well, maybe the government can be more proactive in that, but what are your suggestions on that? Like, how can we make shareholders more responsible for carbon-intensive investments?
Yeah, so I think it touches on what I said about, you know, really ensuring that we, as sort of the individual network that comprise, you know, broader investment opportunity and the LPs that actually invest behind funds in the first instance, really sort of catalyze our own personal investments and pensions towards sort of better outcomes. So looking into whether or not your pension, for instance, invests behind some of these things that should otherwise, you know, might otherwise not move the dial towards an outcome that you're fundamentally aligned with. We also think that if you can remove some of these distortionary sort of impacts or conditions within the market, that will only help facilitate a better outcome. But then I think, you know, you have this policy drive that also needs to do things like make it investors' fiduciary duty to really fundamentally allocate towards sustainability. So, you know, for reference, a lot of policy right now sort of says, within the fiduciary duty parameters, it's okay to integrate sustainability. But it doesn't say you have to. It doesn't say you must, which is absolutely bizarre, right? If you think through, like, how do you invest and therefore what is the best outcome for your stakeholders, you obviously want to think through sort of long-term externalities. So in our view, you know, again, it's this multifaceted approach.
Thank you, Shalini. I know that Nikki is really a big advocate of carbon tax, and so I really wanted to ask her about, like, how do you see carbon tax on companies?
So I'm not even sure whether it's necessarily just a tax, but that's one way of doing it. But we have to have, I mean, it's Nalini's point about having an internalization of the externalities. So price has to somehow reflect the cost to the environment or the value of the climate in absorbing the CO2 that we've got. So while, you know, carbon tax in its various ways is a possible mechanism, there are also other ways of doing things that, apart from taxation, there might be either regulation or whatever. And I'm not too bothered about that. But as long as we have to have some value on the climate's ability to absorb carbon dioxide. And we can do that through either a tax or an incentive or whatever. So from my point of view, if we have an incentive, we are going to have to take carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere. It is unequivocal. It will have to happen. At the moment, there is no incentive to do that. There's no value. There's no revenue stream in doing that. If there was, through either a tax or an incentive or a subsidy or however you want to set that up, then you would find a whole lot more technologies which would come on board to do that. So it's really comes back to that age-old thing of not internalising the externalities. And if we really did do that in some way, shape or form, if I was being really neoliberal about it, I would say, actually, I'm perhaps not neoliberal, but there are different political ways of doing it, but I would say, okay, you could do everything from regulating for it, so you must make sure that you responsible for your waste product, which is the CO2, in the same way that we do for packaging and things like that in the European system. Or it might be, okay, so you oil companies, fossil fuel companies, you are ultimately responsible for taking carbon dioxide out of the ground, and therefore you are ultimately responsible for putting it back again. and that might be a tax or a charge on the extraction. So, I mean, there are certainly different ways of living. Carbon tax is not necessarily the only way, but we have to reflect the value of the climate services in the price of the fossils. Historically.
Can I just add something? So the IMF sort of reported the total aggregate subsidies given to fossil fuels recently, and it's something like $5.3 trillion, which is like over 5% of total global GDP. That is nuts, right? Like, if you think about that, there's no way that the status quo is fit for purpose. And so carbon taxing, definitely one way forward. Sort of openly talking about the way that we're actually allocating capital today towards unbeneficial outcomes is another part of the debate. And then you're having like totally revolutionary ideas around maybe even carbon tax doesn't go strongly enough forward. And I don't know if anyone knows about sort of the Green New Deal in the US, but I mean, it's like maybe carbon tax isn't even enough and you need to create sort of this grassroots movement that fundamentally sort of changes the way that we interact with our policymakers and create sort of lobbying power and collective action such that you can really combat some of the forces that are quite sort of incumbent within the status quo. So there's so much to be done and so much innovation happening, but it's exciting, but I think a definite call to action.
Thank you. Just to summarize, I think, we really need a systematic level approach and all stakeholders need to be come together. Otherwise, we are going to breach the 1.5 degree limit. And for the disruptors which are coming to the market these days, to help us achieve this target, I wanted to ask Nicole, what are the alternate funding options they can have? To convince different investors, maybe, or different alternate sources of funding for the companies which are at forefront of sustainability, but they are not easily getting the money.
So I think the space that we operate in is called off-grid solar, and that is a fairly new industry. So historically, if you rewind about 20, 30 years ago, solar used to be a grant-funded government initiative where the government would hand out solar lanterns or solar streetlights to communities that did not have access to energy. They would very quickly break. People lost faith in the whole technology and said it would never work. There was no process of servicing and maintaining that. There were a few companies that started to say people can actually pay for solar and it's a technology that could work. But the big question that investors would have is this a scalable business? Right? So you can continue to get social capital, which is you can get grants, you have folks like Shell Foundation who continue to support businesses of various sizes trying to provide access to energy. But if you're talking of companies like, let's say, Generation, they are asking harder questions, which is it a scalable technology? Is there any sort of commercial return that we can expect even if it's in the future? So we are really excited that Generation has made an investment in Mkopa, which is their smallest investment, is their first investment in Africa. But they're seeing hope in the technology, saying that, hey, this is something that could potentially scale. Maybe that's what I think. Right? So that's exciting. So again, if you look at the problem like you were stating, about 1.2 billion people do not have access to electricity. And between 2010 and 2018, we had 38 million people getting access to electricity or power through just solar. Right? So it's a small drop in the ocean, but it's still not insignificant anymore. Earlier, the question was, is this really a thing? Is this a business or is this going to be a social cause? But I think that that question has been put to rest. Mm-hmm. It'd be backed by good investors, CDC, LGT, Generation. So these are also the strong investors who evaluate our business in par with most of the commercial businesses. So it's really exciting for the space as well to show that this is a really exciting space where people can create huge social impact, phenomenal environmental impact, and also create commercial returns in the process. So I think it's a really exciting place.
Thank you. Just following on that, from what I'm aware, there is also another challenge that investors face is the IP protection of the technologies. So IP protection can be useful for the investors to make sure they get the returns, but also it can be an inhibitor factor in wide adoption of the technology. So how do you propose as a balance for the future for the investors to invest in like technology companies and also let it outsource? Because ultimately, the overall arching aim is like we must be below 1.5 degrees, and factors like this can inhibit it.
So it's a good question and sort of gets to the heart of like, how do you simultaneously mainstream sustainability outcomes while making some sort of profit for your stakeholders as an investor? I think we think through barriers to entry and sort of the moat of a technology or of a company having to come from a lot more than just IP. So you want to make your IP scalable for sure, but you also want to make sure that you're assessing the company's ability to execute and really fundamentally, you know, take the product beyond just sort of a niche into something that is mainstream. So we will only invest behind trends that we think there is a massive market for, and we will invest behind the company that we think is going to be sort of the dominant market leader behind that technology. And I think when you have that scale advantage, you are able to open up your IP to make it sort of public source, but you really have the ability to continue that innovation cycle such that you are a generator of ideas constantly and really leading the fore for that. So you have the best team, you have the best product today, but you also have the best potential to keep innovating for future products. And so, you know, a lot of that is just part of our own process in-house for how we arrive on the right types of assets to invest behind. But it's an exciting time when you have a sufficient number of sort of competitors within a market to really make that analysis, frankly.
I think this whole IP protection thing is a really, really interesting one for an entrepreneurial audience where I think, if I'm really honest, I think sometimes it's overdone a bit. Have you got patents? Yes, we've got patents, but you know, actually since we filed those patents, we've come up with about 10 even better ideas because the market's moved, the clients have moved, I've met new people with new problems. And so yes, patent is something, but I think it's much more around if you want to be scalable, then you're basically an IP business which is generating value all the time. And you might not be the ones that actually deliver that, but there are ways of capturing that value by working with other parties to scale. And certainly in the climate arena, one of the things that I'm very keen with Origin Power, we are an IP business because if we were to build the stuff that we're designing, it would just take us too long. We wouldn't be able to have that amount of money on our balance sheet. And actually, so it's about getting quick deployment of technology through a licensing process. And I think if you've just got one patent, there is every possibility that little niche for that patent will disappear in a really volatile, moving market. And actually, what you really want is a whole range of IP and keep generating. And I think that it's that quality of IP generation which is probably the investable thing. I hope so, anyway.
And the debate isn't new, right? Because it's been ongoing in like pharmaceuticals for so long. The idea that you might have like a malaria drug and you want to bring that to market, but how do you make that scalable such that it's reaching the audiences that you want it to in the first instance? And so our view is that, you know, something like what the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation are doing to actually sort of subsidize or sponsor new drugs to scale, to be dispersed in the best ways possible, is really interesting, and the sort of ROI that you can create on that in the long term is really quite significant. And so I think these types of incumbent models of business innovation are no longer necessarily fit for purpose, but that you're seeing sort of new models of innovation and sort of, you know, the platform approach where you have multiple IPs to really sort of go to market is quite impressive.
We add our own perspective on that. So M-Copa holds the patent on the IP on having a SIM card inside a battery that can turn it off and turn it on remotely by collecting money through mobile payments. So we own the IP on that. We, as a business, chose to use it more in our defense, which means if another business comes up 3 years later and does the same pay-as-you-go solar technology, we don't want them to put us out of business saying, oh, we filed for IP first. So we filed for IP, we own the IP, but there are five other businesses using the same technology. We've never gone on the offensive to sue them or try to put them down because we think it's for the broader good that, you know, access to electricity, access to light is the right thing. Whether it's the right strategy or not, time will tell. But so far, that's the philosophy of the founders and the team, that we own the IP mostly to protect ourselves, but we think it's good that the technology is getting out.
Thank you. I'm going to go back to the origin power, Nikki, because you have been heavily involved on a very technical startup. So how difficult has been for you to raise the money for that?
It's quite difficult. But raising money is quite difficult anyway. You have to kiss a lot of frogs and you have to find the frogs that have the same worldview as you, and if everyone had the same worldview as us, then we wouldn't be in this situation in the first place. So I'm hunting a rare beast, and you know, Generation is one of those rare beasts, and they're you know, right across the board. There are pockets of investment for the sort of stuff that we're doing, but it's, you know, it's slog, and you just have to put in the slog. But you also have to be very clear about what your business case is. And I think the interesting thing about tech. Entrepreneurship is you have brilliant people who invent brilliant stuff that I could never possibly come up with, but they don't necessarily have the right mindset to work out how you take that to market, and so it's that kind of diversity team approach which enables you to marry the tech, the commercial story, and the operationalization of it, which you have to have all together. Then you have to go around, tell your story to lots of frogs. and also the situation changes at whatever stage you're at. So, you know, early stage seed is totally different to the next stage, which is totally different to the next stage, and people are looking for, investors are looking for different things. So it's a fascinating world. I have to say, I have found it completely fascinating. I think it's broken in some places, and I think it will change quite a lot as more money comes into the sector. And I hope that it will be easier. And it will slightly move from this ESG approach, which is doing less badly, funding things that aren't quite as bad as the rest of their asset class, to actually funding things which are actively good, which might need a little bit more patience in terms of capital allocation. That's my hope.
Well, Shalini is next to you for round of investments.
I'm just glad she didn't call me a frog. we're pretty series agnostic, but we like to see product market fit. And so the stage that we come in is when you are sort of, you know, you're revenue generating, you're just really taking your technology and scaling it. So call that sort of like series C, D, E, late venture, effectively. So a bit later than where Nikki's sitting. But I also spend about, you know, 25% of my time trying to connect companies to people, sort of, you know, investors downstream. And I think to my point earlier, you know, you're seeing a lot of funds emerge which are a bit more sort of infrastructure heavy on the sustainability side, a bit sort of, you know, willing to take more risk in terms of, you know, how capital intensive businesses are. And that's really important because so much of this innovation is going to come from those capital intensity businesses. But frankly, you just need more capital allocated towards sustainability across the market. So, I mean, until it's the case that we're no longer having these discussions because all investors are fully integrating, you know, sustainability into their investment process, I think we'll continue to do these panels.
Thank you. I'm just conscious of time, and I think we should open the floor for the panel, for the audience.
Yes. Hi, everyone. My question will consist of several parts, so just I'll ask the audience and I'll ask the panel. So my name is Dmytro, I'm from energy recovering business at the moment, energy from waste. I am a current student from State Business School Executive MBA program. So as Executive MBA program, we just have a course on leadership, and it was about making change. So it was the framework from Kotter, John Kotter, I think. The first thing was to create the urgency around the problem, which you create. One of the other steps was how to communicate your vision to other people. The second part. I'm from energy recovery business, energy from waste. And people very often against this. People are against changes because usually we create, to make a change, we create a threat. But the person who, another person who deal with waste, and his name was Saki, and he write the book, Make Waste Great. So he argued that to make a change, you need to make people to think positively about things. So they should love to do this. The last part of my question. How many of you ever check the energy value of food which you consume? Good. The question probably will be more to Shalini than to Nikhil, and probably then to Nikhil. So how you as a business let people know that you are proud of reducing CO2 emission?
Yeah, excellent question. On the food waste point, we've actually invested in a company called Toast, which is sort of on the cover point of sale for small and medium-sized restaurants out of the US. But what it actually does is change the entire sort of processes by which you order food within a restaurant and connect it to sort of the back end of the restaurant, such that you're receiving on things like inventory and you reduce food waste and you're able to really just sort of drive efficiencies throughout the whole space. And so one of the ROIs, they never really thought of themselves as a food waste company. They were just saying, you know, restaurant owners, hey, you can save like 50% of the costs that you currently have through not throwing out food at the end of a week, which is pretty compelling, I think, to a small business who has pretty tight margins. So something we're totally focused on. And then I think we take that type of investment and philosophy. And you know, part of our mission as a company is to really try to be advocates for what we're doing, but also for our companies. And so about 2 years ago, we launched what we call our Sustainability Trends Report. And we've started putting Al on a bunch more stages to speak through, you know, what commercial innovation we're seeing in sustainability. And we used company examples. A couple of years ago, we spoke about Mkopa in particular, to really highlight what the commercial opportunity is, because I think a lot of investors will push back and say there's not sufficient, you know, opportunity here, so we have to diversify our portfolios, and in order to do that, we have to allocate capital towards things that aren't necessarily sustainable, but that's what we owe to our LPs. We think that that's probably in, like, the wrong way of thinking through things, because you're not actually diversifying risk so much as sort of creating, you know, I can keep going. But to answer your question, totally, we think it's incumbent on us, I think, to really sort of drive change through being advocates. And so we talk about sort of food waste, we talk about every sort of sustainability challenge in front of whomever we can. I mean, I sit on our investment team and was very keen to give up a Saturday, even though I'm not sort of outsourcing companies, in order to help try to catalyze change. And I think that's an axe against all of our heads. I also think it's, you know, it's quite interesting, having left university in the States, and this isn't to slag off another institution of learning, but you leave and you think that your career opportunities are going to be consulting or investment banking, or like you go into law or you become a doctor, and so you have those four options. Which one will you pick? And to think that there are so many viable opportunities for people who want to work hard, like at Origin or Mkopa or at Generation, and those are just becoming sort of more and more, is a really interesting time in the market. So multifaceted way, hopefully, of answering
I'm just going to go around like this. Please be concise.
Thank you.
In a space like this, there's often a focus clearly on finance and technology, which are really critical, but I thought it was interesting, Shalini, that you mentioned the ability to execute as both a barrier to enter and a barrier to success. I think there's often financed sound technologies that don't make it. So I'm curious how you guys see that need being addressed, and I think you just touched on it now. How are we going to find and source or develop the skills to successfully execute something which may have sound technology and finance, but isn't necessarily being executed in a successful way? Will there be a refocusing to do that? Will it be redeveloping skills? How do you see meeting that need?
Admittedly, I'm kind of speaking less with an origin hat on, but more of a kind of 30 years in the sector hat on it. And there is a desperate skills gap, but both technical, but also possibly slightly less understood is the softer commercial side. And I think what I find really difficult to find is people who have an understanding of the tech, and the, you know, sort of tech and science, basic science, combined with commercial skills. And so at the moment, I'm having to cobble together a team of people who some have the tech and some have the commercial. We have to kind of sit down and, you know, really kind of work as a team on it. And in due course, they will become commercially literate tech people and tech literate commercial people. And I think that's possibly the biggest need in the market for this transition, is people that can actually speak both languages. Speak tech and they can understand it, and they call it. Otherwise, what you end up is with commercial people who don't really understand the tech and they're scared of it and therefore won't invest in it, and tech people who can't understand that the needs of the investment community are different from, I've got a really good piece of tech and you need it. And they need to say, I've got a really good piece of tech for this person, for this organisation, and this is how they will make money out of it. And that is, for me, is the skill set that's missing, is that real kind of combination of tech and commercial.
So I think business schools should come at the intersection of these two.
And the tech, I mean, it's again, on the tech stuff, I mean, how many people are here from a kind of a tech background? As in not necessarily digital, actually. So now put down if it's digital. Okay. So I just think the understanding and the study of science and technology is desperately needs boosting, both in this area and in politics.
Thank you. My question is really for all three of you, though I guess Shalini, you can probably speak to this first, but I know it's very common in private equity to maybe, once you invest in a company, to have someone from your firm, sit on the board of a company, or at the very least, help it guide its management. So since you're saying, all three of you are saying, private may invest in companies with longer term horizons, where investments may pay off decades of the line, as opposed to in the more immediate sense, like this, firms are doing nowadays. What does your sort of guidance or management style look like now that you maybe are investing in these longer term technologies? Like, how do you guide these companies? Is there a difference in strategy?
Yeah, so more recently, actually, what we've started doing because of the stage that we invest in, so this is actually very sort of peculiar to Generation. But actually makes us quite differentiated when we approach a company in the first instance. So it's not the case with Ancopa, which is still sort of, again, earlier stage relative to some of our other investments. But by the time that we come into a company, the board tends to be full of investors, right? And the last thing you need are more investors on your board because there's such a little diversity of opinion. And so what we've started to do is take an observer seat such that we can still be, like, totally fluid in everything that's happening with the company and report back to our LPs in an appropriate way. But we put an industry expert on the board. So we'll spend, you know, so much of our diligence time really just thinking through with the CEO and his management or her management teams about, you know, what they really need to have on the board in order to scale. And then we go out into the market and try to find someone who's devoted their lives to, you know, go-to-market approach or international or, you know, technology and product development. And we say, you know, hey, do you want to do something cooler and more interesting that can really move the dial for the future? And I think because sustainability still tends to be fairly proprietary to our brand, people jump on that bandwagon and want to do something pretty cool. And so our ability to convene and bring in really interesting operational partners to help our company scale tends to be a distinct way that we actually help our management teams. And I think moving forward, that will hopefully increasingly be an approach of private equity companies.
Hello, it's a question for Mikhail. Do you envision Off-Grid Solar down the line to be a solution for Africa that will compete, even if a proper grid is developed for microgrids? Or do you imagine we pivot at some point and change to smart grids or microgrids, still using the innovative solution you have with phone payments?
Great question. I think something that's often asked, saying, you know, we are trying to exploit an inefficiency, so at some point when the grid catches up, what happens to us? So I think there are two ways that we think of the sort of solution 5 years forward. One of which is if you take a household that has no access to electricity. If they have their lights, their mobile charger, their torch, their radio, their fridge, their cooker, everything on solar, and 5 years later the grid comes down and they say, do I really need the grid? Because access to all the things that I need in my home are something that I bought, the asset, I've paid it off over a period of time. So we think if we get there faster than the grid in a way that is more affordable to customers, we may compete with the grid very much, and people may choose our solution more than having access to the grid. There are a lot of customers in Kenya that have access to free connection, but they're not able to afford any of the assets. So which means even if I have electricity at home, I cannot buy a $200 TV because of my income. So what MCOPA does is makes the asset packaged with the energy, and that makes it a very compelling solution for a lot of the people that we're talking to. So our vision is if we are able to prove this model at scale, then newer countries that are looking to electrify are going to debate this very seriously, saying, these are the areas that we can cover on grid. These are the areas that we have elegant off-grid solutions. For a long time, there wasn't any solution that was scalable, but now I think we're giving hope to governments and they're opening their eyes to saying, oh, maybe this is the way forward as well.
I think, thank you. If you could add more on how you are asset financing, that will be really useful for the audience. So just to give you a brief background, the way they do is like for 1 year, they finance only the solar panels and the light system. And once the payment has been made, they sell further new assets, for example, TVs and things. And this, even though the panels have been sold, they can still control the light and force the customers to pay back. So it's an increased level of involvement with the consumer and financing, and like tempting them to buy something like that. So, yeah. It's the whole ecosystem. If you want to add something more.
Yeah, so essentially we are displacing kerosene and looking to give them alternatives. So we start with lights, but we finance them other products on the way. So you start with buying a couple of lights from us. You pay well for a year. We know your track record is good. We sell you a television. You continue to pay well for that for 2 years. Your track record is good. You get a fridge. You pay well. You get a smartphone. You get other assets. So what we're doing is we're displacing the amount of money that they're going to spend on kerosene and using that to finance assets that we believe will improve their lives.
And my question is about sustainable investing, because you mentioned about pensions, and I think there are sustainable funds out there, but they often say that you'll see a lower return because they're limited in what they can invest in, so they might not grow as quickly. So I was just wondering if you comment on that.
They're lying to you.
They're being lazy.
Yeah, exactly. If they're not good enough investors to generate a better return, then like I think you have to ask other questions of them. Our public equities firm, or part of the firm, is one of the best long-only funds in the world. And that's, you know, not within a sustainability niche, that's not within an assets under management niche, that's in the world. So to say that this isn't possible is malarkey.
This question is, I guess, mainly for Shalini, but please feel free to chime in. This goes back to actually this question that you were talking about, that to your first question, what you responded, that you think really, if externalities are correctly priced in, then doing good business and doing sustainable business goes hand in hand. But unspoken that, of course, is that currently externalities aren't correctly priced in. My question is largely, as an investor, how do you act in the present with the knowledge that externalities aren't correctly priced in? And of course, perhaps if I may elaborate, in the longer term, of course, oil isn't sustainable, so long term, if people are thinking, they should of course all be piling into sustainable investments. And my question there is, what's stopping people? Is it just a failure of imagination or misaligned incentives or, yeah.
Or all of the above, yeah, totally. I mean, I think there's definitely a movement happening. We just need to move faster. I think, you know, we say that externalities aren't being priced in, but BP wasn't always known as beyond petroleum. Exxon now has, you know, a $45 carbon price that it charges internally. It needs something more like a $1,000 carbon price, but, you know, it's progress. Slowly. But I think basically, if investors are thinking through the risks of stranded assets and what will be these companies sort of licensed to operate moving forward, then these are just risks that you need to incorporate when you're modeling out the scenarios of longevity and therefore the caliber and quality and valuation of the asset in hand. And so I think, you know, it's both about pricing externalities because you fundamentally believe that the world has to change in order for us to have a world. But I mean, I'd be interested to hear Nikki's view on sort of what you think the commercial opportunity is relative to, you know, fossil fuel companies and why you think that you will have a stronger value proposition and you'll see sort of, you know, people moving the dial to answering the same question but from a company perspective.
I think it's definitely all of the above because, you know, there's all sorts of, you know, reasons why people don't get it. And there's also all sorts of reasons when they do get it, why it doesn't manifest. I'm just thinking of a conversation that I'm having with a company which our technology could basically, they could own the whole market, if, assuming our technology works, you know, with assumption, but they could actually own the entire market in certain situations, which are pretty likely, so in terms of price of carbon or whatever. But because it's a fairly standard, long, old company, they do not have that mindset. And that I think, in that situation, is likely to be the biggest barrier to them. Equally, there are more entrepreneurial businesses which may not even actually operate in our area at the moment, but they can see the writing on the wall, they can look at the risk and the opportunity and the upside of that, and they will probably, you know, come in because they think, actually, I'm going to take a punt on that because it's looking pretty likely, and even if it's not. So there's everything in that whole spectrum. One thing that's really, really frustrating, that has frustrated me over the last 5 years, I got very excited about the arrival of impact investing, this mythical thing, or this mythical label which seems to cover absolutely everything now, which is I think about it as, you know, investing in something that you know to be better, that absolutely creates value in a sustainable way, a truly sustainable way. But one of my frustrations now is everyone's piled into the impact investing market, and now not only do they want the impact, they also want the return next year. And so we've kind of diluted the concept of an impact investment with this idea that you then need to have immediate returns in all areas. I mean, certainly there will be areas which you can get immediate return, but there's some elements where you need to not want to focus on the quarterly reports. There's other, you need to have a little bit of a longer view. There was something else I was going to say, and I can't remember.
Hi, Nikki. I just want to ask about the political will that you kept alluding to. You know, where will that come from? Given that there's this conversation taking place, obviously, at the Paris Climate Accord and other things, what about the country and the political will, and how can we actually drive that conversation forward to create meaningful change? Because companies will only start adhering to things once regulation comes in place. That's usually been the case. Without that, we don't really see anything.
It is absolutely fundamental, and I think it's difficult not to be totally UK focused at the moment on UK political situation. And I think perhaps the UK situation is a bit of a mirror. But two things have occurred to me in the last few months, because there is a sense of there's a different movement. I have a 18-year-old daughter who, off her own bat, has been involved in the school strikes for climate. And I see in that this amazing sort of movement of a different generation getting it and being really, really frustrated with the political establishment. And that's now, an international effort. And I think that, I would like to think, that will be taken seriously and give that political push. The flip side of that is, I don't know how many of you have seen the picture of how many MPs were debating in the UK government this week. I think 610 MPs were missing. Six were there. So there is definitely a political involvement and debate gap, certainly in the UK, and I think that is also in other parts of the world. In developing parts of the world, I think it is becoming a much more politically charged issue, but we just have to get it over the line to action. And Paris brought consensus, but we ain't there yet, and we're in danger of sort of just thinking, okay, we've got Paris, but we don't actually deliver on it. There's every possibility that we can have Paris and not deliver on it. So I don't know how we do it, apart from all of us saying we must, you must take this seriously. Every single one of us should divest from fossil from our pensions, and we should engage in the political process and say this is urgent, claim a climate emergency or whatever. And it is kind of up to all of us to create that political.
Okay, last two questions. I'm afraid we are running out of time.
Thank you. So when we're tackling a massive issue like climate change, so I mean, in part of the solution is scaling existing solutions like COBRA, et cetera, SAFCO, Mobisol, and there's sort of these funds at Series B, Series C who have a lot of money. But what about sort of incentivizing new companies to also tackle this issue? And for example, there's a lack of capital in that area, so how do we really incentivize people start putting money there, because we spoke about this mindset of existing companies who don't like this idea of sort of climate change, but also the mindset of investors who are trying to sort of work in this impact space. But how do we get them to really incentivize new companies to also tackle these issues?
I don't know, but if you find out, tell us.
So I'll speak from my own experience. I think it is happening. It's not happening as much as we'd like to, because it's a bit of chicken and egg. If you talk to the investors, they say, well, the companies are not really ready. The company are saying, I don't have access to people because they don't have access to money. So that, I think, that is a problem that does exist, and you have access to capital in some areas of the world, like Silicon Valley has access to much more capital, and if you have one piece of paper with a half-baked idea, you probably raise more money than if you have a pretty serious idea based out of Nairobi or based out of India. So that is there, but I think a lot of funds are now looking to move into emerging markets, and they're looking for opportunities. In fact, we see a bit of the reverse problem in East Africa, where a lot of the fund managers are not able to identify enough businesses, and there's more money sitting, but there are less entrepreneurs. So sourcing deals are becoming a big problem. So they're starting to engage with college students now, saying, why don't we start incubating ideas in people who are in 1 year before they graduate? How do we create many more entrepreneurship centers across East Africa to source more people? So I think it is happening. It may not be where it needs to be, but I think the journey has started. That's my point.
The last question. Okay. That hand was
good.
Thank you. Hi. My question is based on agriculture and so the farmers in developing nations, say, especially South Asia, we see because of the inefficient irrigation techniques that they have, that's significant. Energy consumption happens there, which really impacts the unit economics. What kind of innovations or policy changes do you think are needed to make improvements in that, or some innovations that are existing in some other markets that can be brought in over there?
Is a question on innovations in water technology, or
it's just if there's inefficient irrigation technologies which are significant energy consumption, how can we solve that? Either through innovation or policy changes, what's your take on that?
My
everybody's
sure. I'll give you my two cents on that. Firstly, it's a huge topic. It's probably out of the scope of what we're covering now, because once you get into water, that's another sort of animal altogether, and I can talk at length about that. So I'd leave that out, and I think lots needs to be done. I mean, similar to how carbon is not being priced in, there's a lot of debate around water not being priced in correctly, not understanding the cost of water, and you see many cities like Cape Town, etc., San Francisco earlier having problems, and people are really not waking up to the problem of water. And when I spoke to a few investors, they're all saying nobody's paying for water, so we can't build businesses that do that. So anyway, water is a different topic. I really want to leave it out of this area, but anything else you want to add?
So historically the unit economics of agriculture haven't really been functional because they're not scalable. And I think that's where you had the intervention of a lot more innovation around precision agriculture, which I think is reaching sort of an inflection point where you're seeing an increasing amount of capital allocated towards it, but you're also seeing increasing innovation if you just sort of scale the number of patents that are being released in that space as a proxy for the types of innovation. Last year, again, the Sustainability Trends Report that we publish on an annual basis sort of highlights some of those trends in particular. So would encourage you to turn to there to get more of a descriptive answer of some of this content, but definitely an issue that ought to be top of mind for sure.
Just to add to this, I think previous year there were a lot of reports on water, energy, and food nexus from the United Nations, and would be worth looking on those. There are a lot of cases, especially the inefficient irrigation practices in Punjab, because if you know, it's like 45% of the wheat and rice is produced in Punjab, and then you have like 2% of the land, which is of the country, which is producing that. So they are using a lot of fertilizers and things, and using water really in inefficient way. So there is a good case study on that. I would really encourage you to look at that.
Thanks, Steve.
And of course, the final question, right, is for me. But it's helpful for you all, most of you all. Okay, for the panelists, if someone has to pitch their idea today to you, what's the key advice you're going to give? I'm sure there are many people who are pitching their ideas.
Be very clear about whose problem you're solving and who along the way is going to gain the value from it.
Practice the pitch. make it succinct. But understand, I think, to Nikki's point, the value proposition to all stakeholders. It's not sufficient to have just sort of one stakeholder benefiting, but you need sort of from a systems level perspective to really sort of move the dial. So know what the status quo is, do your maths, come up with sort of what the aggregate ROI is, and communicate that in a way with passion.
And once you do that, focus on execution. 20% is idea and 80% is execution.
Thank you. Alec, and please, I would request you to please give a big round of applause to the panelists.